And we will move on to case number four, Sidebottom against Broyles.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Brad Schooley, representing the appellant, Mark Sidebottom. This case, I'm sure that my co-counsel and with regard to this will attempt to characterize the obligations between Mr. Sidebottom and the Broyles as debts. It is, however, a fact that the only existent part of this case are claims which were the non-dischargeable claims filed by Mr. and Mrs. Broyles during the course of Mr. Sidebottom's Chapter 7
right,
proceeding.
Right, and I wanted to ask you something. The parties didn't brief this, but what Mr. Sidebottom did was essentially called, you know, a Chapter 20 sometimes. He had the Chapter 7. He comes in with a Chapter 11, Chapter 13, before the Chapter 7 is really once and for all wrapped up, because there's still this adversary proceeding that's going to take place. The trial's been scheduled. And the Supreme Court hasn't said that there's a per se prohibition against simultaneous proceedings, or at least against the Chapter 20 situation. But that's different assets and different debts usually. This is the very same asset, the very same debt, and it seems to me an absolute end run around the Chapter 7 proceeding before the very same bankruptcy judge. And so I have a preliminary question about how it can be legitimate for Mr. Sidebottom to say, well, I have this non-dischargeable fraud conversion thing. Maybe you'll win the adversary trial. Maybe you'll lose. But I'm just going to erase it by this device of filing a Chapter 13 on the same thing before the 7 is done.
Well,
this is kind of a sketchy area. I mean, there's a lot of literature about these chapters.
Yes, Your Honor, about a Chapter 20. The essential part of that, however, is that Mr. Sidebottom received a discharge in
subject
the Chapter 7 proceeding.
The outcome, though, the adversary proceeding wasn't resolved. It was continued for afterwards.
That's correct.
So his discharge does not wipe off what the outcome of the... Because you can't discharge in a Chapter 7 a fraud debt.
No, subject to the rights of the parties to litigate that under 523.
Right. Oh, yeah, of course, if he won in the fraud case. But you can't... But if, as I understand it, you can't discharge fraud.
Actual fraud, that's correct. 523A2A.
Right.
And those were the allegations as well as conversion.
That's the point, yeah.
And those were the only claims which survived, as such, the Chapter 7 discharge.
And I guess my point is, why isn't it, as it were, you know, a bad faith filing? That's how some courts characterize it. To come in with the Chapter 13 to disrupt the process of the trial that's supposed to take place in 2 weeks from the date when the Chapter 13
is filed. Your Honor, the question of bad faith filing, I think, was raised by the appellees in their objection to the plan and also in their motion to dismiss. It is, however, a correct statement of
which
fact.
Which would be an alternative reason to uphold the district court.
Well, that's possible. The district court, however, made no opinion other than to affirm the bankruptcy court. So there were no...
No, I know. The district court is brief. I mean, the bankruptcy court wrote, and we can talk in a minute about... the approach the district court takes to the... to the amount, the $290,525, which was the amount then, is basically to say it's awfully clear it's more than that. So since it's more, we don't really have to pin it down to the
penny.
Well,
I think in our brief we dealt with the question of that number, that actually the total amount that was expended, that was paid to the corporation was the $690,000. And there is no other consideration. So it's really illusory to us in order to determine that that's the conversion amount, because that's simply the difference between what the Broyles calculated that they had received for the amount that they paid.
No, I understand. I mean, your argument, which I think in many ways is a good one, is if you look at the district court, at the bankruptcy court's calculation.
Yes.
What the bankruptcy court calculates is essentially a contract measure of damages suffered by the Broyles as a result of all of these events. Their cover, the need to go to the other company, what they paid that they didn't, you know, the extra things. And let's assume for the sake of argument that you shouldn't use a contract measure of damages. Still, you have to ask, is it clear enough that the fraud conversion damages will exceed, you know, the 290 and change number that there's no eligibility anyhow for Chapter 13? I think that's the issue. And your opponents approach it from quite a different way from the way the bankruptcy court did.
Well, Your Honor, I think the essence of it, is whether or not the damages that would arise out of the fraud claim, and I think we treated this in our brief, could be anywhere close to the dollar limitation. And perhaps more importantly, we don't believe that they're determinable at this particular point, which makes the debt unliquidated.
Right. Now, I realize you're focusing on unliquidated as opposed to non-contingent. And the real question, I guess in my view, one of the questions is it clear enough that they are more than the statutory ceiling that ineligibility can be found?
Well, Your Honor,
I
would obviously say no, but I would also say that I think they're zero. I think in the
well,
final analysis.
Well, that's because you probably are going to say there's no fraud. You know, I assume that's your defense. You know, had you had to go to trial on that claim.
Well, correct. I mean, we don't believe that there's any intent. We don't believe that there's anything here but a contract claim, and that the Broyles claim is built. And I think we also treated this in our brief. Is built on the fraud that supposedly arises as a result of the punitive provisions of the mechanics lien statute,
right?
And they're just not there. Those damages are restricted to the amounts which are paid. I'll try and reserve
the rest of your time. That's fine, Mr. Hammonds. So, Mr. Hammonds, can we start from the premise that the way the bankruptcy court calculated this amount is wrong?
I wouldn't characterize the decision as necessarily wrong. I think that...
But that was a contract measure of damages.
There was a benefit of the bargain element to the way the court calculated those damages.
It was a complete contract. I mean, it was... If you'd been litigating this as a contract case, that's exactly the number you would have come in with.
Understood.
And you didn't. You implicitly repudiated in your brief. Your brief starts with the amount of the 600 and some that was erroneously paid because of the allegedly fraudulent representations about payments and so on. You seem to be backing off from that pretty hard.
Without acknowledging that there's an absolute mistake in the bankruptcy court's decision, we wanted to point out to the court that as well. When looking at the bankruptcy court's opinion, that the $254,000 in what it labeled converted funds could in fact also be construed as fraud or conversion damages in this case, because under the agreement between the parties, the contractor made representations to my clients in order to obtain draw payments towards the construction price. He made representations that, in fact, the work had been completed, as well as the fact that subcontractors had been paid as part of his obligations under that agreement. And therefore, to the extent that he took money through these draws, through these representations that exceeded the value of the work he performed, including whatever profit margin is built into the contract, that, in fact, those converted funds, as the court called them, are proximately related to, proximately caused by the fraud, as well as the conversion. And so I guess you're correct that we did also provide for the court an alternate way that the bankruptcy court and the district court's affirmation of that decision could still be there.
Right, but see, here's the problem with your alternate way, as I see it. As I said a minute ago, there's no problem with calling this non-contingent. I mean, all the events had happened in the past. But it's awfully hard for me to see that $254,000 figure as a liquidated figure. There's a great deal of adjudication that has to go into ascertaining damages from fraud. It's not like looking at a promissory note and saying, well, you know, here's the amount that's going to have to be paid. And it's not even like looking at the contract, which if that were a measure of damages for you, that would be at least a number. Everybody could agree this is the number in controversy. But, of course, the contract damages are under the discharge, I assume, in the Chapter 7 case, which is why you only had the fraud trial left over. And how can you call that $254,000 figure a liquidated figure?
The court based that number on the proof of claim that was filed by my clients in the Chapter 13, which is prima facie evidence of its claim.
But the other side, I mean, proofs of claim is not enough to make something a liquidated figure.
Sure.
Scheduling it as a proof of claim, and you're, you know, Mr. Sidebottom contests that number.
Sure, and there is a dispute in this case, and certainly that dispute is out there. And,
well, some
and
disputes are over liquidated things, and other disputes are over unliquidated. You know, tort damages typically are going to be unliquidated damages, and fraud is kind of a tort. So in terms of the Chapter 13 eligibility, that 290,000 and some number that applies to this case, it's gone up since then, but needs to rely on liquidated amounts. So how can you do that in this case?
Well, I believe that when you look at the amount of the draws taken, which was about $678,000, when you look at the contract price, the contractor's built-in profit margin that's included in there, when you look at the fact that when we ultimately had to bring in another contractor to finish the job, that there was an amount to which that additional contractor's costs exceeded.
But why is that the proper measure of the fraud? I mean, and actually your payments, I mean, I looked at the schedule of your payments. You know, it's a 10, 20, 20, 20, 10, 10, 10 schedule. So nothing actually equals $254,156 in that schedule.
I believe, though, for 109E purposes, for making the determination of whether this is, in fact, a liquidated debt, that the bankruptcy court had adequate information in the proof of claim, in the record that was before it with the contract, to get to a number that would exceed the $290,000, $525,000.
Okay, now what about the bad faith aspect of this? Did you object that it was not appropriate for Mr. Sidebottom to file a Chapter 13 while the same court was still wrapping up the Chapter 7?
We did, Your Honor. In our motion to dismiss, in addition to the 109E issue, we also alleged that the case was filed in bad faith under the In Re Love standards for a bad faith filing. Mm-hmm. The bankruptcy court, in its decision, because it determined that the 109E cap was exceeded, did not address the bad faith filing issue. But we did assert that, and we were prepared to make that argument. And this isn't the end of this argument. I mean, if assuming that the court affirms the district court and the bankruptcy court's decision, Mr. Sidebottom is going to get his opportunity to ultimately litigate what the actual damages were to a precise number and whether there's any liability for those claims in the context of that pending adversary proceeding in the Chapter 7. He'll get a full and fair opportunity, and we believe that's the appropriate place that this should have been dealt with, as opposed to...
Well, of course, he's hoping that if he gets this Chapter 13, then it goes away altogether.
Sure.
I mean, that's his plan.
Sure.
Right?
And I think that's plays into the bad faith argument that, in fact, he could have filed this Chapter 13 from the beginning or from shortly after getting his discharge. Instead, we continued to litigate or move towards a trial date on the adversary proceeding, only to have the Chapter 13 filed then 2 weeks before the trial.
Do you agree that this debt is dischargeable in the Chapter 13 proceeding? I know you're objecting to the plan, but is it in principle dischargeable?
I believe the fraud and the conversion components subject to 523 are not dischargeable to the extent there are contract liabilities. Those would be discharged under the Chapter 7 discharge. But because there's a pending adversary proceeding for the fraud and the conversion components, that portion of the claim is still out there and would not have been discharged by the entry of the court's discharge in the case.
But if he gets his Chapter 13 plan approved, I'm asking in the Chapter 13 aspect of his proceeding, do you agree that the fraud and conversion claims can be erased?
Sure. I believe that under the so-called super discharge provisions that are available in the Chapter 13, that even fraud and conversion claims would be subject to discharge upon full performance of the Chapter 13 plan. And I believe that that's part of the policy, public policy issue at stake here, is whether you allow people who have fraud and conversion type of claims that exceed that cap to be basically put to the super discharge standard of a Chapter 13. I think Congress made an effort to basically place a cap on what you could do in a Chapter 13. I mean, basically limiting theft and conversion and those types of things to a smaller amount. And I believe that very policy issue is at play in this case. I believe for that reason, this is a liquidated, non-contingent unsecured debt that exceeds $290,525, and we should be given our opportunity to present the evidence in the adversary proceeding that he is personally liable and that those debts should not be discharged. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. How much time?
2 minutes.
May it please the court, I'd like to address for a moment the bad faith issue. And I think that Mr. Hammonds would confirm that at the outset of the litigation on the objection to discharge, because of the financial circumstances of Mr. Sidebottom, it was indicated to them both verbally during discussions or depositions and also in writing in settlement proposals that this was the course of action that Mr. Sidebottom would take. He would avail himself of Chapter 20, as in effect, rather than incur the expense of what was anticipated to be rather lengthy and expensive litigation concerning the objections to discharge. That, in retrospect, may have been tactically more costly than the other course of action. But at least the record would reflect, and I believe that Mr. Struan indicated during the course of the hearing that was, in fact, disclosed to them and discussed with their counsel that would be the course of action that Mr. Sidebottom would take. So from the standpoint of being surprised with respect to the filing on the eve of trial, I don't believe that element exists.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.